Thanks, everyone, for joining us for this conversation about how to capture the beauty of the birds of Juneau with a camera. I'm Rhonda McBride. This is not easy to do. The birds often flit away before you can so much as focus. But we have with us Brenda Wright with the Juneau Audubon Society. She joins us every Friday to spotlight three birds each week, and we'll get to that later in our program. But in our weekly visits, Brenda provides us with recordings of the birds' songs, as well as photos for our website. And many of those are taken by Jessica Millsaps. So, if you're at your computer, go to the Friday, July 16th Juneau Afternoon page on ktoo.org and enjoy some of her work as we talk. And keep in mind, she's only 19. Yes, 19. But then again, Brenda Wright has been working with Jessica Millsaps for a long time.
Actually, Jessica was a young volunteer. She started helping with the Hummingbird Project 7 years ago?
Yeah.
You know, small hands are good for small birds.
Especially hummingbirds, my goodness. So what are you doing with the hummingbirds? What is the goal of the volunteer project with the hummingbirds?
Oh, well, actually, right now, this particular hummingbird banding project is the longest one in Alaska. So we're trying to find out more about how long they can live, how well they survive, what the age and sex ratios are. They don't go much farther north in here than Anchorage. So it's something really interesting for people to find out, especially a bird that lives on the West Coast, which is having trouble with environmental change.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine that such tiny birds that are moving so quickly could make it from California to here.
I know. They come on the backs of geese. Did you know that?
No.
Actually, I think they go on their feet. Well, that's an old tale. But they do.
Oh, you had me there.
They do come right after the sapsuckers arrive, though, because the sapsuckers give them juice. The hummers do take advantage of the fact the sapsuckers are here and drilling holes in trees so they can get sap if there's no flowers yet.
How do they get here? Are they just on their own power?
You bet. It's amazing to me that some of them can arrive in early April. Depending on the year, that could be a very, very low year for flowers in early April. Depends. But then when they leave to go south, they go on the alpine. They wait till the alpine's in full bloom and go south on the alpine so they can mosey on down south with no headwinds.
That, to me, is amazing that they can make that kind of a migration, being as tiny as they are.
It is amazing. There are many, many species of hummingbirds in North America that fly across the Gulf of Mexico. If that doesn't blow your mind, I don't know what would, because they're so tiny. And the shortest distance is 400 miles.
And they're not riding on the backs of geese or sandhill. You really had me going there. Duh. So, Jessica, what fascinates you about hummingbirds?
Just their small size and their high metabolism. Their really shiny feathers. The males have really bright colored feathers.
So how do you get close to them?
You set up a feeder.
Do you have a net to catch them with, band them?
We have hull traps.
So is it kind of like trapping a butterfly?
Yeah, you could say that.
So what was your first aha moment with the hummingbirds when you had one close at hand and you said, I didn't know that?
I didn't realize how small they were in hand.
And how small are they?
They're about the width of my hand in total, beak to tail.
And you have tiny hands.
I have tiny hands.
I would be very afraid to handle those. I would fear that I might crush one.
In the very beginning, when I started, I was afraid I was going to crush them in the net. So I had a lot of hard times pulling them out of the net. Over time, I learned that they're actually very tough birds, and it would take a lot to hurt them.
So do they make noises when you catch them?
They do. Some of them more than others. They're like people. Some of them are a little cranky when you manhandle them. Make a lot of squeaks or chirps. They may sound like they're complaining.
So tell me what it is that you love about the birds.
I love that every bird has a different song. Every one of them sings something different.
Jessica, how long have you been taking photographs of birds?
9 years.
And at what age did you start?
I started at the age of 10 when I received my first camera.
And what kind of camera was that?
It was a little Nikon pocket camera.
Those don't seem like they would be great for taking pictures of birds.
They're not. Autofocus is not ideal for birds.
Well, they're very hard to take pictures of because they don't sit still for you.
They don't.
And they don't appear where you want them to appear. Mm-hmm. So how did you begin to adapt to that, you know, starting out from a small pocket camera?
Christmas 2016, I received a Canon EOS Rebel T6 and two lenses, a 300mm and a 55mm lens. And I could actually manually focus it. And I loved it.
I imagine that could be the beginning of really getting good bird photographs.
Yeah, I advanced very quickly with that one.
So what was it like in the beginning stages of trying to photograph birds? And why did you decide that was what you loved to do?
Well, I have always had a very strong interest in birds. It started off before I started school. I started off identifying the birds in my backyard at the bird feeders. That's pretty much where my interest started. The hummingbirds were especially interesting to me because they were so small and fast. And then we had the really pretty red poles that would hang out during the winter. When I got my first camera, I was able to actually identify them. So I'd take pictures of the birds and then grab my mom's bird book and identify them.
Where are your favorite places to try to take pictures of birds? Do you have any secret spots you could pass on to us?
They're not really secret. I take a lot of pictures at my own house. I enjoy going on lots of walks, so I always take my camera with me. I've had a lot of luck taking pictures at the glacier, around the visitor center, at the Mendenhall Peninsula, where we check tree swallow boxes. Kingfisher Pond is a great place for birds. The community gardens, where we trap hummingbirds. Ockrack is a good place for seabirds.
Can you pass on some pointers about how we can get ourselves positioned to take some of the wonderful photographs like you've taken?
Tell her how the camera's a part of your arm.
Yeah, with the bigger lens, the camera's pretty much part of your arm. Usually when I'm taking pictures of birds on an overcast day, I try to position myself so that the bird is not in front of the white sky. So I'll try to get another tree in the background or a branch. Make the background a little darker so that the bird itself, you can see its colors.
Time to take a short break, and we'll be back with more from Brenda Wright and Jessica Millsaps. That will give you a chance to visit the Juno Afternoon webpage at ktoo.org. Click on the Shows and Podcast tab, then go to the Juno Afternoon section. And from there, click on the Friday, July 16th page to see pictures of some of the birds we'll be talking about. So join us for some more armchair bird watching when we come back. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Thanks for being here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride. We have been talking with Brenda Wright from the Juno Audubon Society, along with Jessica Millsaps, a longtime volunteer who helps to track hummingbirds, puts up boxes for tree swallows to nest in, and still finds time to take wonderful pictures to share with bird lovers, something that she's been doing since she was 10 years old. We have a sample of Jessica's work on our website, ktoo.org. Just go to the Juno Afternoon page, dated Friday, July 16th, so you can follow along with our conversation. In our armchair bird watching session, I started off by asking Jessica about her photo of a little mountain bluebird. And boy, is it blue.
It is. I absolutely love that photo. Just the fact that the bird is blue and so is the background.
How did you get that photograph?
We heard that there was a mountain bluebird hanging out around the golf course. So we headed out there on a Sunday morning, and it was sitting right there on the fence when we got there, which doesn't happen very often for us. So we approached slowly so that we wouldn't scare it off, and it allowed for a surprisingly close approach. I think we were within 20 feet of it.
Wow, this is just perfect. Now you have another one of an owl. What's the story behind getting that one? It's kind of hiding there in the branches.
One morning, this past fall, I woke up to very noisy Steller's Jay calls in my neighborhood right outside my window. And I got up and looked around the yard and didn't see anything. I was hoping it was not a cat. We have a lot of those in the neighborhood. And I didn't have any luck finding what it was. After breakfast, my sister saw something fly out from my neighbor's yard, but we didn't get a really good look at it. Seconds later, we received a text message. Our neighbor had just seen a great horned owl sitting on their roof, and it disappeared again. A little while later, we found it on another neighbor's shed roof, and it was just sitting there in plain view. We got a few pictures of it and then left it alone. And not long later in the afternoon, we found it up in that cottonwood tree. To get its picture, because it was an overcast day, I had to position myself so that there was a pine tree in the background. Otherwise, the bird would have turned out very dark and we would not have really been able to see it.
All the racket that the Steller's Jay were making might have been because of the horned owl's presence?
Mm-hmm. They do not like predatory birds.
So I guess that's another tip. If birds are making a lot of racket, there might be a predator in their midst.
Mm-hmm.
How hard is it to get a picture of a great horned owl?
They're mostly nocturnal, so pretty difficult. We don't see them very often during the day.
This next photo that we have up on our website that you can look at is called Greater Yellow Legs, and you can kind of understand why. Tell us about this bird and what you had to do to get this bird's picture.
Getting a picture of that one wasn't too hard. We were out at Echo Cove on the beach when we saw them. A flock of about 7 flew in and landed on the beach. 6 of them were on one side, foraging around for bugs. And this one was on my other side, slowly walking along the beach, and he just approached, and then I guess he decided to take a nap there. He was up pretty close.
I guess it's all a matter of being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And having the camera glued to your arm. So, Brenda, you're probably pretty impressed with all these photos, especially taken by someone so young.
Well, you know, if you practice a lot and continuing taking more and more photos and then sorting through them and looking at the ones that are best, it takes a lot of work, but it also takes an eye and an ear and the talent to actually have the time and the camera glued to your arm.
So how many other Jessica Millsaps are there out there that you know of?
Oh, well, I'm very, very lucky with that. Since I am not a photographer, I ask anybody that I know that is a good photographer for help. Everybody's very generous for a poster or for a presentation. They are very generous with their photos. You just have to ask three or four of them, and then you'll get whatever species you desire.
So I imagine then that Jessica has been a good source for you.
She's an amazing source. An amazing source. Yeah, she's very generous with her photos, and they're excellent.
So we have some more birds here. A song sparrow. You want to tell us about this photograph?
I was taking a break from trapping hummingbirds last summer, and I found myself surrounded by a bunch of these song sparrows. They were all very curious about me, and this one started approaching me on the fence. And then he just kind of sat there and started preening. And that's when I got my photo.
So how hard is it to get a photo like that, where the feathers are so defined and the eye is wide open?
It's not very hard. You have to have a lot of light.
Our next photo is a Wilson snipe.
Mm-hmm.
I love that name, a snipe. So what did it take to get this photograph? This must have been quite a nice surprise to catch it in the grass.
Yeah, especially in short grass. We usually find them hiding in tall grass out in wetlands.
So where was this photograph taken?
This one was taken around Sunny Point.
What do you think about this photo, Brenda?
Oh, it's marvelous. They only surprise you. They don't pose for you hardly ever, especially the young ones. Burst out of the ground at your feet, fly up to your head, zoom away, and then always jump backwards about 15 feet when that happens.
So they like to take you by surprise.
Yeah, they're busy doing their thing, and they're not the one to run away so much as just jump up and scare you and then fly. So to get one that you can actually see most of its characteristics is really great.
Maybe help us appreciate what Jessica has accomplished with these photos, because I think most of us think, we can just take our cameras out, snap something, and we'll probably come back with a blur and not anything like this, where you really get to have a good look at the bird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very obvious when she's concentrating on taking a good picture. Everything else stops. She's holding the camera. She's adjusting it. She's watching what the bird's doing, checking the light, checking the background, checking the ground, checking her camera, and then taking pictures. She's very, very concentrated.
So our next one is the Arctic tern, and that's another one that is hard to capture because it's always flying around and moving very quickly. But this one, you've got some nice light from underneath its wings highlighting it so we can see all the feathers. So how did you get this one?
I was out at Photo Point, Mendenhall Glacier, last summer. This one flew by and started hovering over the water, and the sun was just coming up over Thunder Mountain. So the light kind of shined right through its feathers like that, and I thought that was really, really cool.
Do you think you'll ever put together a book with your collection of photos?
Possibly.
How many photos do you have?
Probably around 7,000.
7,000 photos.
Yeah.
Is that often the case, Brenda, that you have to take a lot of photos to be able to get just those ones that really show you the bird?
Right, right. And most people I know that are great photographers have taken hundreds sometimes of a single species just to get that one perfect light, perfect feather, perfect activity of the bird to show you what it's really like.
Each photo, Brenda, I imagine, is a testament to patience.
Yep.
Yeah.
None of these happens without a great deal of hard work.
Watching Jessica grow up and be involved with the Juneau Audubon Society for so many years, how do you think that that's helped her, being someone on the outside looking in at a young person's development?
Well, all I know for sure is that she's been a terrific asset to us. She's just been a great volunteer with hummingbirds and tree swallows. She's totally dedicated to birding and learning more and teaching more. So she's my teacher.
You know, that does sometimes happen, that the young people become our teachers. especially when they get really good at something. And you feel really good because it comes back to you in some ways, doesn't it?
It sure does. It sure does.
So what about just being out in the woods and sort of traversing the same ground, the same marshes, the same spots, but constantly being able to see new things? What do you think that does for a young person?
I can't believe how exciting it is to go to the same place and get to see something new every time. It's just the most important part of being in nature for me. It's like, oh, it's my first bloom for the year. It's my first bird of that species for the year. Oh my gosh, you know, it's exciting. It's fun.
It is.
How do you feel, Jessica? Even though you're revisiting the same trail, the same spot, your own backyard. Is there always that new feeling of discovery?
There is. I love spotting my first of any species of flower or bugs or birds, the element of surprise.
So what are you looking for this summer? A special moment in your lens?
The last 3 years doing the tree swallow project, I've always wanted to capture the moment a tree swallow chick takes its first flight, hops out of the box for the first time. That would be really cool. You see them laying inside their boxes all summer. Finally seeing them outside of the box is pretty cool.
So you'd like to be able to show that progression?
Yeah.
I see a book coming, don't you, Brenda?
I hope so.
Well, before we go, we have three birds that we visit every week, try to get to know a little bit better. So tell us about our first bird.
Well, this one you might recognize, the mallard, which is one of our most common birds in winter. They also, some of them, actually do stay here and nest. One of the interesting things is most of the sound that you hear, the quack that we all think of as a duck sound, is mostly done by the female, not the male.
You so mean the females are the quackers?
She's the quacker.
Well, let's listen. So what are they doing right now? Have they had their babies?
Yes. Most of them are actually getting very close to flight. They do have a long period. Sometimes they have start in May and some of them start in June. You might see two females with really tiny ones or ones that are almost as big as she is. They have to get their feathers, so they'll be with us for a little bit before they go out to the tide flats.
So what's our next bird of the week?
Well, this is one that just comes to visit us in the summer. It's a savannah sparrow. And as you might think, it likes high grass. It lives in the grassland. It comes just as the grass is getting tall, builds its nest, stays here and fattens up really well on all our wonderful grass seed, and then heads south.
Is it musical?
It is. I think it has a really pretty sound.
So our last bird of the week that we're spotlighting?
It's the Bonaparte's gull. I'm sure you're going to love the sound of this bird. It sounds like a broken horn to me. I don't know.
Let's listen. Well, we've all heard gulls, and usually they're complaining about something, aren't they?
Yep. But this little guy just comes for the summer. It's the smallest gull we have here. It's even smaller than the mew. It's got a nice black head, and even if it's a young bird that hasn't mated yet, it's still got a little bit of black around its eye. The rest of it's white. It likes very small fish. So when you see them swarming around, sometimes the whales, that's what they're doing. They're looking for the little tiny ones that nobody else wants to swallow.
So they work in partnership with the whales.
Sometimes. They do indeed.
Okay. So just in wrapping things up, I'll ask each of you, and I'll start with you, Brenda. Where are you birding these days? What are the spots that you suggest are good to be at?
I'm still really enjoying the grasslands. The warblers are still here, but they're feeding and not singing. So they're hiding themselves, and it's much harder to find small birds if they're not singing. If you go in the grasslands, then the birds pop up near your feet, fly over, scold you if you're getting too close to the nest. So you get to see a few more.
How about you, Jessica?
As migration season approaches, I would highly recommend the grasslands as well, the wetlands for sandpipers and plovers, the beaches as well.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for being here with us. Jessica Millsaps, who photographs birds and has amassed a huge collection that keeps growing and growing. And, of course, Brenda Wright with the Juneau Audubon Society. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you so much, Rhonda.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon, and thank you everyone for joining us for what I think is going to be a great conversation about Romeo the Wolf. I'm Rhonda McBride, and my guests are Dr. Emily Kane today, Todd Hunt, a composer, and Nick Jans, a well-known writer. And of course, the thing that we're going to be talking about is a project called The Wolf Who Came to Juneau, and this is kind of a multidisciplinary hodgepodge of projects to celebrate this wolf's legacy. And I thought we'd start off with you, Nick Jans. You are author of a book called A Wolf Called Romeo, and it's well known. And maybe you could recap the story of Romeo for people who may be new to Juneau or just sort of refresh our memories.
Well, Romeo was a black wolf who appeared for the first time in the winter of 2003-2004 out near the wetlands and along the Montana Creek Corridor and out finally near the Mendenhall Glacier. And of course, we're in Alaska and you see wolves, but this wolf was exceptional because we got to know him as an individual. And I say we, I'm saying we, the people of Juneau, got to know him collectively as an individual for a period of 6 years. And he was, instead of retreating from people, extremely interested in seeking social contact, not exactly with us, but with our dogs. And by extension, it became us. And I lived out right by Skater's cabin, looking out over the lake. And suddenly I had a wolf in my front yard. You know, the old saying, a wolf at the door, took on literal meaning. And I'd come to Alaska back in the late 1970s to become a wolf and bear biologist. That's what I wanted to do. And I ended up in the Northwest Arctic living and traveling with Inupiaq Eskimos and had seen many, many wolves and observed many wolves and had hunted them with the Inupiaq. And I moved down to Juneau because I met a cute gal who was a dental hygienist, and that was that, and ended up building a house out by the glacier. And as it seemed, I was there to witness the life, and indirectly, but in a sensory way, but a very direct way emotionally, the death of this wolf. And this one animal became part of Juneau's story.
So let me stop you there. Let's backtrack. So how did Romeo get the name Romeo?
Well, he was interested in dogs, as I said. And like everybody else in Juneau, I brought my dogs out to the glacier, which was actually our backyard, to let them off leash and go ski with them, throw snowballs with them, play fetch with them. And we had a beautiful cream-colored lab named Dakota. And one of this wolf's first love objects was our dog. So there's my wife, Sherry, who considers all our dogs her furry children, with her arms crossed, looking out over the lake at the wolf, waiting out on the ice for us to let our dogs out to, you know, do their morning business, you know. Said, so, well, there's that Romeo wolf again, you know, with the same disgusted tone you might give to, you know, the guy who's hanging out in the convertible with the gassed back hair waiting for your daughter. And because she cleaned half of Juno's teeth, the name got around. And it stuck because it seemed to fit. And increasingly through his life, it seemed to fit because he was indeed a tragic hero, a tragic character caught in the web of life and time.
Wow. It is ironic because as you said earlier when we were talking before the show that Shakespeare starts the story of Romeo and Juliet with
Yeah, he says, these two star-crossed lovers take their lives. We're told right up front that now you're going to watch this happen. And that is exactly what I felt, and a number of us felt, was what happened here. The story played out. There's this wonderment. Wow, there's a wolf out there. And the next breath, oh my God, he's dead.
So before we tell people about how he died, talk about the wonderment of Romeo. I think people were so captivated by this wolf that was so approachable and would come up and play with their dogs. In fact, I think he was more interested in the dogs than the people. Why was that? Are there any theories about why Romeo behaved that way?
Oh, sure. Well, wolves being social with people and with canines is nothing new. They're social animals like us, and here is a wolf on its own. It should be with a family. And what happened to his family is always a good question. Some people say, without doubt, that he was a lone survivor of a pack that got trapped up in Nugget Basin. And there certainly were a number of wolves trapped up there, and you just draw a line down the hill. It's not very far for him to end up as a lone survivor. And there was a pregnant female black wolf who was hit by a taxi out on Back Loop Road just before he showed up. And there was no doubt about that, because that wolf was stuffed and exhibited at the glacier for years, that female wolf. And some said, oh, that was his mate. But I think that's very doubtful, because he was a young wolf. He was an adolescent, under 2 years old. And those wolves usually don't get to breed. It's not out of the question, but I think it was more likely his mother or an aunt.
So Romeo died very suddenly, and it took the community... Oh, it was a gut punch to the community. Can you tell us what happened to Romeo?
Sure. But remember, there were 6 years in between. That's a long time, especially when you consider, I'll get to that point, but especially when you consider, it's just important to understand that the average wild wolf, and this is according to biology, okay, by studies and statistics, is fewer than 4 years, and most wolves live 2 to 3 years. Not because they couldn't live longer, but because the life of a wolf is so hard. They get kicked in the head by moose. They drown crossing rivers. They get caught in avalanches. They die of starvation up to one-third. They die in interpack strife, fights between neighboring packs. So this one wolf living that long, there were 6 years in between when we first saw him and his death. And here we are. He died in 2009, and here we are. He's still alive. He's still with us. And he's a very real, vibrant force that many people feel. If you went around Juneau and checked how many people have a photo of Romeo or a remembrance of Romeo, and it's thousands, literally. I mean, he's part of our story.
Before we run out of time, because the clock is quickly ticking away, tell us in a nutshell how Romeo died.
Well, he was shot by two serial poachers who were, one guy had moved here escaping a checkered past, and his buddy came up, and they plotted directly to kill this wolf because, as they themselves said and were overheard saying, they wanted to inflict pain upon the people of Juneau and also have something to brag about, killing this famous wolf. Okay, so it was a very deliberate act, and it was an execution-style killing. Exactly where it took place is a little bit open to debate, but not a whole lot. And those guys were found, they were caught in possession of the hide, found guilty in a court of law just down the street, and let off with basically a wrist slap, because the life of a wolf in Alaska has never really counted for that much.
But this wolf was a different wolf. And I want to turn to you, Todd Hunt, and talk about what it is that drew Junoites to this wolf. And maybe what did Romeo mean to you?
Okay, so I first heard about Romeo. So I've always been a downtown dweller, and I don't make it out to the glacier very often. And actually, for a large chunk of time that Romeo was here, I was living most of the year in Germany, so I wasn't around. And consequently, and I think I told you this, Nick, a while back, I never actually saw Romeo. But the story and the synergy between the wolf and the community is magical. It was magical, is magical. It still is. I feel like I know Romeo just from all of the reading, and especially over the last couple of years, working on, you know, a big piece, you know, musical piece for Romeo, and getting others to do the same thing.
So as part of this A Wolf Who Came to Juno, mm-hmm. there's going to be musical compositions, yeah. and you've written some of them.
Right, yeah. So let me back up a little bit and sort of talk about why this is so big, I guess. It has so many different parts is because, well, actually, after Nick's book was first released in like 2015, something around there, I got it right away and read it and thought, oh, wow, this needs to be an opera, because that's what I do with stories I like. I try to make them into operas. And I thought about it for literally years and couldn't come up with a good angle for it. And finally realized that this sort of magical thing that happened in Juno can't be expressed in one way. I think it needed to be done in music. It needed to be done in poetry. It needs to be done in dance and in visual arts, photography and painting. And that's the way we can get so many different of our ideas about who Romeo was and what he meant to us. And that's where we would find the truth, in a story.
So, Emily, can you explain how this is all going to roll out? Because it just seems like lots of balls are in the air. How are they going to land?
Yeah, us roll it out right now. So it started, as Todd said, from reading Nick's book and realizing the potency of this stunning, unique animal, but that it didn't really lend itself to sort of a single medium. And Todd's really great at taking something abstract and putting it into an artistic form that will actually create a legacy for Romeo in new ways. Of course, Romeo has a legacy through Nick's book, but we'll be creating other aspects of Romeo's legacy and also allowing the community to interact with ways that are authentic to them. We've got Juno Nordic Ski Club has gotten very psyched about doing a Romeo race next winter. There's going to be fireside chats where Nick's going to be in attendance, and we have working on curating a stunning photo show of the 20 best images of Romeo that's going to be rolled out on the first Friday of February. Todd's compositions and the which I'll ask him to talk a little bit more about. There's going to be a performance that will be more formal with music and dance and libretto. That's going to be occurring at the end of February, probably at Thunder Mountain. There's going to be, did I mention the fireside chat? Nick is doing a kiosk to commemorate Romeo next to Patsy Ann.
I'm hoping to make that happen. It is, it's not by any means a done deal, but fingers crossed.
So we're going to be active with this, and anybody who wants to learn more about the Romeo Project can go to the orpheusproject.org. Take a look, spread the word, and of course we're in fundraising mode to help all of these projects roll out, and I'd appreciate any support you can.
So how can we help?
Yeah, there's right now I'm running a GoFundMe specifically for the photography book. I want to make a high-level art quality photo book, a limited edition photo book, and I'm about a quarter of the way towards my goal with GoFundMe. And you can either go to GoFundMe and type in Romeo the Wolf, or you can go to the Orpheus Project website and learn about that. So any amount of contribution, but we're going to do a joint fundraiser with Juno Nordic Ski that's going to roll out in September. And just check into the websites, into Orpheus Project's website, and you'll learn how you could help make these projects come to life.
So in closing here, Nick, why don't you wrap things up for us? We can go to a website to find out more about the details as they become available. But why all this fuss about a wolf?
Well, I think it's, again, because this wolf has become an integral part of Juno's story, and it's a very unique part. I mean, how Alaskan can you get a wild wolf? And you know, you mentioned that he was, you know, more drawn to dogs. That was so, but he also clearly knew individuals and was without a doubt a friend, in the sense that we would use the word friend between humans, with a number of humans that he recognized, would allow or even approach, and not because they fed him, because nobody that I know did. He was hanging out, not because there was any social benefit other than he liked us. And I would go out and ski, and sometimes that wolf would come trotting across the lake, and if I didn't have any dogs with me, he'd still approach and yawn and give that affable little canine stretch, play bow, and lie down and look at me and just look at me and just kind of squint in the sun and say, "How's it going, boss?" And I'd say the same to him, and I would go on and ski on my way. And it wasn't just me. Harry Robinson especially had an absolutely wonderful and almost unbelievable one-on-one relationship with that wolf.
Well, it just sounds like an amazing project. And so, Todd, just to send us off, where can we go for more information? And I'm sure lots of people are going to want to find out about this project.
Yeah, so our website, orpheusproject.org, that's O-R-P-H-E-U-S, project.org. We are updating the site every day, trying to put more information on it, and we're also in the middle of a big update, too, so if it doesn't work or something, please keep trying back. But yeah, we live by grants and individual donations and donations from the business community. So anybody who's interested in supporting us, we greatly need it. And these things don't come cheaply, especially with all of these tentacles we have going out. And I did want to mention one other quick thing is Joel Bennett is worked on a piece that is going to go into schools, and a composer, Alina Levy, is writing the music for that, and it will be able to take Romeo's story into the classroom and into auditoriums for kids to learn more directly.
And
about.
This is like elementary level, right?
Yeah, elementary, maybe middle school, but yeah, so lots of stuff.
All right. I hate to close here, but we have another guest waiting for us. So I want to thank the three of you for coming here and giving us a taste of what's to come. And please, by all means, come back and fill us in, because it sounds like this is a work in progress, an amazing work in progress. So Dr. Emily Kane, Todd Hunt, a composer, and Nick Jans, who is a well-known writer. Thanks so much, all of you.
Thanks, Rhonda.
Thank you, Rhonda. Thank you for having us.
It was great to have you here.